Hello, Dom Knight here. Welcome to The Double Disillusionist. This is a live event recorded at Giant Dwarf in Redfern on the 7th of November, as well as my co-host Andrew P. Street. Our guests were Anthony Green, the ABC's election analyst, and GetUp's marriage equality director Sally Rugg, talking all about the survey and, of course, the ongoing schmozzle involving dual citizens. Our next live event is at Giant Dwarf on the 14th of December. Our guests will be Lenore Taylor of The Guardian and Sean Kelly, who writes that wonderful daily column for The Monthly. You can book at giantdwarf.com.au. There will also be special book events for the books that Andrew and I are just about to release. So look at the Facebook page for more info on that. But in the meantime, enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Giant Dwarf on an amazing evening for Australian politics, because in half an hour's time, the postal marriage survey will have finished. Round of applause, please. It is over. And if you're in the room and you haven't voted, you're too late. You are too late.
This best $150 million we ever spent.
It's been an extraordinary campaign. It's been an excruciating campaign. Let's do it all again next month, shall we? An amazing time. Also, of course, the citizenship ongoing debacle. Who will it be? The Senate President, the Deputy Prime Minister, some rando who used to play tennis and is somehow in the Parliament. It could be anyone at any
point. See, my guess is that the next Senate President is going to be that DJ from Tasmania, though. I think DJ Nut the Cunt, I think was his name.
Something like that. Yeah. That famous meme, Howard DJs like a mad cunt. He is the mad cunt. Who is the model for that meme?
Finally, with closure.
But I think it's about time to welcome our guests, is it not?
I think that would be it's an opportune time.
Now, look, very, very excited to have these two guests. They've both been incredibly important, particularly at this point in time. First of all, please welcome Sally Rugg, who is GetUp's marriage equality director. She's been debating conservative Christians on the television. Lyle Shelton, and how many times have you squared off, Sally, with Lyle?
So only once, and now that all the votes are in, I feel like that was my one shot. And you know, we debated for about 25 minutes. It was a pre-record, and they only aired like 2 minutes of it, and I was really disappointed.
So they left out the bit where he completely changed your mind, I
assume. He's a yes voter now.
And also, of course, the ABC's election analyst, Mr. Anthony Green. Please welcome him. And as you know, Anthony, of course, is first to call every election. And if someone else tries to call it first, they're guessing. He's the one who knows. And I think this is the first time we've ever been able to say, but of course, don't forget, the polls close later in WA. And Anthony hasn't been working. So please give him a round of applause as well. Welcome to the stage. And I thought it might be a nice place to start with how someone becomes the ABC election analyst and has that job. And the most asked question, how much does Anthony work in between elections? I know the answer is an awful lot. How did you get into this gig, Anthony?
Oh, it's a long story. It goes right back to the 1970s. I originally did a science degree majoring in pure mathematics and computing. And there's a funny story. Actually, I had this strange bromance date last week. And as you do when you're trying to...
Vote yes.
As you do when you're trying to impress people, I took along a whole bunch of newspaper clippings about myself. And
as you do.
Which is why I'm single. But
that's how my wife and I met.
But
by the way, didn't they warn us that if we voted yes, soon bromances would be legal? Oh.
Kevin Andrews was right. Do they cycle? That's the question.
Yeah, do you cycle?
I'm a very keen cyclist.
There you go.
It's funny, I was looking through a couple of profiles of me, and there's this sort of strange gap. After my science degree, and then 4 years later, I went back and did politics. And the reason for that was, in 1980, when I was 20, I sort of came out as gay and finally realised all that. And then got involved in the homosexual law reform campaign in 1981 and discovered the world of politics and the law and stuff that my family background had absolutely no background in. And I thought, this is interesting. And I went back to university in 1984 and did a politics degree, politics economics. And the interesting thing with that was that I sort of drifted out of any form of activism after that point. I mean, age was hitting full bore at that time, and it wasn't a very exciting time to be involved in stuff like that, and I just concentrated on my career. And then at the end of that was hunting around for a job, and the ABC advertised this job for a researcher for 6 months to work on the 1990 federal election. And at the time, I was looking at economist jobs, and doing an econometrics degree. For Christ's sake, I didn't get into that. I could have been doing the finance reports. And I saw this job for a researcher for 6 months at the ABC to work on the 1990 election. I took a 40% pay cut to take this job for 6 months. And the day I accepted it, they had 150 applicants. They interviewed eight and then went, well, this guy's good. So yeah, and I had the computer background. It was just huge. So that was, I think they really wanted me to talk to the computer people. So they hired
me. You literally mean that there was an enormous computer behind you?
No. I had just a big computer. I had a computer background. So,
You're not fooling anybody. I know.
Sorry, I'm just being literal. Something went off my head.
1990, the computers were as big as a house.
Yeah. But anyway, So a wonderful man called Ian Carroll, who was one of the legends of Australian television news production, picked me from this big field and gave me this job. I had to do a book of notes and talk to their computer people who didn't understand how journalists worked and stuff. And at the end of the 1990 federal election, which was the only thing I was hired for, Andrew Olley and Paul Lineman and Kerry O'Brien all said to the head of news, you should re-employ this bloke, he knows what he's doing. And so they gave me the job of redesigning the computer system, which I did. I designed the database we still use. And then someone stopped me on camera and they thought, oh, this guy makes sense. And then in 1993, there's a wonderful story about 93, because it was the first time we used my computer system and I was on camera. And it was the first time we had the complete matching of polling places to get rid of the early bias in the swing. And from very early on, we showed Keating winning. And the ABC board was meeting in Sydney at the time. And they'd all decided that Keating couldn't possibly win.
Hashtag their ABC.
And when these computers were showing Keating winning, these phone calls started from Sydney. Get Green off camera. Stop using that computer. It's wrong. Keating's not winning. Anyway, it just went on for about an hour and a half and they stopped using predictions. And eventually we called it and we were right. And so everyone was very nice afterwards. Yes, I knew you were right. You know? Yes, it was really us that did it. You know. So it's just both from there and people like Kerry O'Brien and co gave me a huge, you know, wanted me on camera, wanted me there saying what was going on. And he just built from there and I've become a sort of minor cult celebrity. So.
Absolutely. I know we, for many years, got Anthony to do...
I was going to say, clearly not minor.
Yeah. And always a very, very good value with cameos. At one point with The Chaser, we actually had gaff tape over his and Kerry O'Brien's mouths and strapped them into office chairs to keep them silent. But I should point out as well, just a little bit of behind-the-scenes info. If you're an ABC presenter, you get access to the private Anthony Green intranet. And he actually has this incredibly large database, every seat in every election. So every time you see an ABC presenter being smart about some minor detail of Australian politics, like going, oh, well, of course those booths in the north of the electorate always trend green early on, that's him. That's his brain farmed out across the organisation. It's a wonderful asset.
Literally trending green. Thank you.
But of course, politically neutral as he works for the ABC, no one in there has any views at all. Now, Sally, how did you come to work for GetUp at this amazing time in history? I mean, what a time to be a marriage equality director, given this incredibly weird, unforeseen postal survey.
Was it unforeseen, though? Because that's what we took to the High Court. It was not unforeseen.
Oh, yes, of course, it was important and...
urgent.
Urgent and unforeseen was how the government was
really
able to...
It crept up on us, didn't it?
Yeah.
If only someone had talked about that issue before, it would have been 4-1.
Yeah, that was their argument and how they could legally misappropriate the money on the postal survey. How did I come to GetUp? Do you want me to tell you about what I studied and stuff, or do you want me to tell me what, like...
Yeah, I'm just curious about how you got that particular job. Why GetUp as opposed to anyone else, and why become a campaigner as opposed to any of the other things you could have done with your life?
Yeah, sure. Well, I already really cared about like queer rights and LGBTI justice. And I remember seeing, do you guys know that beautiful GetUp ad where it's like the viral video and it's that very handsome man and it's kind of like this point of view video and you follow him around Sydney and then right at the end he gets down on one knee and there's some other good dude he's proposing to. So I remember watching that. And that was back in 2011. And back in that day, the idea, A, that there was a sort of an ad on TV about marriage equality was amazing, but also the fact that the production and then the ad buy on that was completely crowdfunded by a bunch of people who really cared about this issue and wanted the government to act on it. So that was what really piqued my interest in GetUp, I suppose.
And probably also that it was a formal wing of both Labor and the Greens, as we now know.
Both of them, yeah.
How's that even possible, anyway?
And then was living in London, moved to Sydney, was working at an organisation adjacent to the Royal Commission and was studying my master's in journalism, thinking that I just really wanted to like shine a light on the issues that mattered to create change. And then I realised, no offence to the journalists in the room, that that is largely like not what journalism is.
Unless you start crowdfunding your own opinion website, right? Am I right? If you haven't heard this, Andrew's become an entrepreneur. He's for $3 a month, you get all the opinion you can possibly. His first article was like 5,000 words long. It was like completely over-delivered, but it's a wonderful thing.
But you've created that job for yourself, right?
Yeah. I have, but that's mainly because I discovered where you can get S Club 7 gifts.
So decided I didn't want to be a journalist. I got a job at GetUp working one day a week, and my job was to call people whose credit card details had expired and get their new expiry date, which I always thought was stupid because you could look at it and be like, well, it's 4 years from then. But you got to call people.
I would have thought you couldn't just, enter it in and keep charging them, all right.
Slipped in the door then, and then within sort of 6 months, it was the 2013 election, and it's just sort of moved up the ladder, and now I'm a director.
And this campaign, I mean, it seems as though this issue's been bubbling away for a very long time, ever since John Howard changed the Marriage Act. I guess it's been before then as well, but the intensity of this campaign has been quite extraordinary. It's dominated the news, well, until the citizenship debacle that we'll get to a bit later on. Just every day, over and over again, what's it been like for you personally fighting that campaign and having to make the same patient arguments day after day?
It's been really hard, actually. And I can say that because the polls have closed and I don't feel like something I say is going to make thousands of people vote no just to spite me, which is what a lot of people have said over the course of the campaign. It's been really hard. As a queer person, the concept of having the nation vote on your worth and your rights under the law, the media scrutiny, just not being able to escape it ever. But also as a campaigner and someone working, leading the campaign alongside other people, I felt extraordinary pressure to deliver a yes vote, but also to avoid a no vote, which would have been catastrophic. So it's been really hard, and I'm glad it's over, but it's also just been so astonishing. At the beginning of the campaign, we couldn't have dreamt the public enthusiasm and the volunteer response and just how many people came on board. I mean, the voter turnout is just unbelievable. So it's been a real roller coaster, and I'm glad it's over.
5 minutes to go. Can we now reveal that the No campaign were right? It are going to make every child wear a dress in school. Is that actually net? I still can't believe the argument.
I'm looking forward to finally getting icy cold bottles of that delicious sounding gender fluid that everybody's been talking about.
Now that the campaign's over, I actually feel like revealing something that the No campaign didn't know. And that is, one of their arguments was that if you change the definition of marriage, then churches that don't recognise that sort of marriage might be prosecuted, and everyone said that's rubbish. Well, that actually did happen in New South Wales in the 1920s.
We've still got four and a half minutes to go out.
Nobody tell Western Australia!
All of you turn your phones off, okay? All right.
Back in the 1920s, the Attorney General in a Conservative government at the time, because anti-Catholic bigotry was massive at the time, and there was a pronouncement in the 1908 by the Pope that they didn't have to recognise civil marriage, that if you weren't married within the Catholic Church, you wouldn't necessarily get the sacraments, and they wouldn't do it, they wouldn't recognise divorce and the like. And someone tried to criminalise Catholic priests who wouldn't accept a civil marriage or divorce. And they actually passed this law for the New South Wales Parliament, and it was repealed a couple of years later, so it never took any effect. But just on that, the Attorney General who passed it was a guy called TJ Lay, who's probably the greatest L-E-Y. He was known as Lemonade Lay because he also wanted to ban alcohol, but he... He was also the only New South Wales Attorney General who was a convicted murderer.
How?
He was convicted of something called the chalk pit murders in Britain about 20 years later. But later on it was also discovered...
There's still time, Lyle.
While he was an MP, and in fact while he was Attorney General, two of his opponents in politics strangely disappeared. One of his opponents, and he says, was found dead at the bottom of the gap in suspicious circumstances. And a Labour candidate who ran against him in the 1928 federal election and threatened to lodge a writ against him in the Court of Disputed Returns disappeared and was never seen again. And it is now widely suspected he was responsible for both that. So he was the man responsible for that act. So maybe that's why no one ever mentioned it.
Sally Rugg, is this helpful to the Yes campaign at this point?
Yeah, it comes a bit late, Anthony.
Known this, would you have been much, much more careful around George Brandis?
I was sure Jared Henderson would have known that. That's what was amazing, because it was deeply anti-Catholic stuff.
Well, and look, the Catholic priests and the criminal law is another whole conversation. So the... Don't groan, come on. You know, I didn't do any of it.
They just move to another parish?
It's funny because it's true. Poor George Pell, having to close your eyes that often. Tim Minchin said it. And he talks through the process from here. So the it's too late. People are dropping off their ballots at the very last minute in Perth for the next minute and a half. After that, the ABS somehow tallies things up. How does the process unfold from there? Maths, I don't understand that stuff.
In some statistically unweighted way.
Who am I, Anthony Green? Yeah.
I've got to say, I remember the 1970s when there was a series of reforms introduced by the Rand government for things like what they call victimless crimes, and they were trying to do things, and they decided to allow de facto marriages, the black tie relationships to be registered. They criminalised rape within marriage, and the outrage on both of those changes to law by the churches was amazing at the time. But in those days, and I remember going to an anti-nuclear rally in the early 80s, and the gay groups were all marching along going, "Gays against the nuclear family, no fast breeders."
That's solid.
But no one was after marriage then. And in fact, it was thought impossible for a long time because they thought the High Court being very conservative, no one tried it because the High Court would have been conservative and then and said, no, that's not marriage. Now, the court's changed since, and the perception is that it's the right of the parliament to define marriage. Plus, if they didn't broaden the definition, the states have referred all their de facto powers to the Commonwealth, and there would be such a mess between the constitutional definition of marriage and the referred powers definition of relationships, you'd create a nightmare. And so that's why it's all changed. But it was never an issue here until it was banned.
Yes,
that's the amazing thing, yeah.
It was never an issue until Jack Tomlins and her partner got married in Canada and came back over to Australia. And you're right, and then John Howard quickly...
Yeah. What happened was Australia's a signatory to the Marriage Act, the Marriage Treaty, and we recognise marriages in other countries as long as those marriages aren't in conflict with our law, which is how we have different age consents when they're dealt with. We don't have to recognise child brides from other countries because that's not our law. But we had no definition for same-sex marriage, no bar on it, and Canada had allowed it. So someone was going to try and use the Marriage Act to say it's legal to bring your marriage here and have it recognised. And so that's why they quickly removed the thing from the Marriage Act. So, I mean, that's where it came from. It was never an issue in this country, really, till that point. Then people said, well, why can't we have it? And so that's where it all started from.
And people say Howard wasn't progressive, banning something so early in the process. And that's why hundreds of thousands of us, including me, had to get married with that weird little couple of seconds where the celebrant reminds us that, in fact, what you're doing is a discriminatory act at that point. There's just a little moment that creeps into any marriage service right now.
The line is to be reminded. One man and one woman to the exclusion of all others. And like, I know that off by heart. I don't go to that many weddings, but as a gay person in the audience, you don't hear that line and think of some like imaginary infidelity down the track. You hear that line and it says one man, one woman to the exclusion of you. And it's like a smack in the face every time.
But even as a straight person, you note it and it's a little sour moment. And no one takes to the exclusion of all others bit seriously. So why we have to follow that?
Or the for life bit, which is the other bit that's on there as well.
I'm not sure people really understand the legal consequences when they do these things personally.
When you say these things, do you mean bang outside of marriage? Or
getting married.
So
it's like the Constitution. We don't bother reading it. We just turn up.
My niece was prevented from moving out of Sydney because of a marriage dispute and access to children. So, I mean, marriages can have all sorts of impacts on your life, which people don't always understand until everything goes wrong.
This is the be careful what you wish for argument, which still comes up occasionally.
I'm dreading all the marriage gifts I'm going to have to buy now. I'm just dreading.
Might I suggest maybe some books on Australian music or Australian politics? Quite popular wedding gifts, I'm sure.
Have you got them at remaindered prices yet, Andrew? Yes. Next month we're going to completely flog up, but we both have books coming out in the same month with the same publisher because we're the same person. So yeah, get ready to be spanned about that next month. So on the 15th of November, what are we expecting, Sally? Where will you be on that day?
I'll be in just across the road at Prince Alfred Park where there's a big results picnic.
Oh, there's a big there we go. We're all invited to the picnic, are we? Are we
Queen
all turn up?
Everybody come. I'll be drunk.
Is it 11 in the morning, isn't it? Is that when the news comes out?
10:30.
10?
Oh, 10. 10, yeah.
All right. I'm going to be sat at a computer going, refresh, refresh, refresh.
Also drunk.
And the Commonwealth statistician's going to be the one that gets up and...
It's at a particular time, he'll get up and read it out, but the release with the figures is going to come out. The ABS releases all sorts of statistics, you know, GDP figures, employment figures, inflation figures, and because they're all price sensitive to the money markets, they're very strict, and if they say it's at 11:30, it's 11:30 seconds, and that's when it happens. And so you got the money markets, they're all going refresh, 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 and then they go bang, you know. I don't think it's going to be quite like that, but yeah.
There was a very astute point, actually, that Ms. Alice Workman, friend of the show, made on the Is It On podcast, which is just what a subtle and elegant fuck you it is to get like professional statisticians to deliver the results of an unweighted, voluntary, completely meaningless survey. Just sort of say, your job doesn't matter at all.
I think it's an outrage, actually. When was the last election held in this country that I didn't call?
Exactly.
Rude. But no, there was a brief period during the campaign which we all found, those nerds who've been following closely, I just love this. For about a day or two, we thought that the ABS was going to be obliged to adjust the figures. So to try to collect information on who'd voted, and if not enough young people had voted, as one presumes was the plan, from requiring people to go to the post box for the first time in their lives... they would have to weight it so that their views were actually taken into account. And can we get another bottle of red up on stage? We're going to need it. And I just point out, even though it's...
Daddy needs his medicine.
Anthony, I expect you'll do your own weighting of the results. Just, there's a hobby.
No.
Because you're like our sophologist, Ben Rowey.
I promised to take someone out that evening to improve their credibility. Look, I'm interested in a number of things. What is the overall figure? What's the figure by state? How many electorates voted yes and no? Is there any difference in certain types of electorates with high ethnic minorities, for instance? Mm-hmm. And what are the return rates by age? Because that's of interest to me. So those sorts of statistics I'm interested in, because if it passes in every state, it makes it very hard for senators to say I'm ignoring what my state says.
That's unfair. Corey Bernardi can do that.
Yes, he's not commenting. He could legally under the rule. Yeah. One of the fascinating things about this process is it will, even though it's not in any way an actual election, it will be broken down by electorates. Potentially to try and put leverage on individual MPs to go one way or the other. Is there then going to be a process of lobbying and horse trading, Sally? Are you going to have to start making phone calls and talking to people about how they're going to vote?
I think, I mean, to pass a bill, we have majority support in both houses of parliament for this piece of legislation and have done for years. So I think, I mean, this phase of the campaign is less about passing, like gaining support for passing a bill. It's about the complexities of the bill itself. And so GetUp members and a bunch of friends across the movement will be focusing on making sure there's a marriage equality bill that doesn't give new license to, you know, discriminate against LGBTI people at the shop counter.
Hashtag not all bakers.
Yeah, it's going to be strange, isn't it, that you're going to have a majority in both houses voting yes. The poll's telling us that it's a yes. So let's spend $110 million finding out what everyone thinks. You know, it's going to be a strange process.
I'm actually curious, Anthony, given that this was a voluntary vote, did the turnout... I think the final turnout that they've reported is about 80%?
It's 78.5. They've been doing it so far based on, you know, mass guesses of how many envelopes have come
do
in.
Do they weigh them? I love this idea. They've actually put them all on a scale. So
they're not weighted, but they are weighed.
They're weighing them, they've been scanning them, so they've been comparing the weights with what they scanned. They'll now scan them all, but, I mean, there'll be a whole bunch of return rates. It'll be interesting to see what the percentage yes is as a percentage of the enrolment of the country. If it reaches 50% of all enrolled voters, it'll be interesting. But as a comparison, I think the Brexit vote in Britain, I think, was about 73% turnout and 50% yes, 52% yes. And no one has questioned the credibility of that survey. They've ploughed on ahead. And they had no detail of what Brexit meant either. So, I mean, it's in this case, it's been a mechanism to permit a parliamentary vote from within the Liberal Party. That's what it's been about.
Anthony Green, would you say that the exceptionally high turnout for the postal survey is a testament to some excellent campaigning?
We are recording. This is going straight on the CV.
Yes, it's also been a testament to...
Thank you, that's enough.
Yeah, look, the No campaign have given it their all, haven't they?
It's a testament to the fact that people are used to voting, that the question was quite simple. Some people wanted to say, do you support marriage equality? And these people would have gone, what's that? Same-sex marriage, it made it clear what people understood that debate.
No talk of bridges in the question, which was useful.
They got the survey, it came quickly, people answered it and sent it back. So I think it's a combination of knowing what the question was, knowing what it was about, people used to voting, and it was a big issue. It was running in the coverage, so people responded. So you compare it with voluntary local government postal ballots in this country, which might only be 23-24% turnouts, simply because nobody knows who the candidates are. This was something where people knew what it meant when it arrived.
Thank you so much for bringing up the phone banks that we ran, because they were extraordinary.
I think, Sally, after the few months you've had on the campaign, you're allowed to gloat all that you like about how it has
not
been
me,
a huge.
It's the people who
it's
did
been
it.
A huge effort, and there's a lot of people in the room here who've worked on the campaign. But what I'm interested to know is, for all the money that was spent both by the ABS under Matthias Cormann's dictates, by the different campaigns and the $1 million for the Anglican Church, which went to from this very diocese that went to the No campaign. Has the needle actually moved in terms of the opinion polls? Do we spend all of this money and everyone still thinks the same thing they did when we started?
Yeah, so the like public opinion on marriage equality has been settled for the last few years. So I mean, we don't know the result yet, but the projected results are very much in line with the public polls, which is actually great because we thought it would be a whole lot lower. And the nature of this campaign, because it was voluntary, because it was done over the post, it was focused on turning out the vote, getting people who already supported marriage equality to post back their envelope. So there was some persuasion elements to the campaign, but we've been running a persuasion campaign on marriage equality for a decade.
I've enjoyed the Australians' coverage of their polls, news polls.
I haven't.
Because
I've never heard that sentence before. I've enjoyed the Australian.
No. I'm this long time observer of this sort of stuff. They've done, I think, four polls, and every time the poll was showing the yes vote dropping, it was on the front page. And when the third one came up and the yes vote was rising, it was on page 4.
What are you trying to say, Andy? I can't possibly...
And then, no, they published all the details, but it was the prominence they gave to it. It's, they actually do always publish them. So as I always tell people, don't read the headline, look at the table. And the tables are all there, so give them the credit for that. But the other thing was that on the day they put it on page 4 as the yes vote was going up, on their website that afternoon, they ran that strange Twitter survey that predicted a no vote. And that was top of their website that afternoon.
Oh, that bizarre thing in the conversation. That was a wonderful last-minute G-up to the Yes campaign, I suspect.
Also, I mean, like, I was trying to pass out what the stats on that were meant to prove, which seemed to be banking on there being an awful lot of over 55s on Twitter, which... Yeah, yeah. Seemed ambitious to me.
Why? Because your methodology picked Donald Trump on a low turnout, which means you're going to get a high turnout on single issue. I don't know.
It was junk. That survey was junk. Even if Yes doesn't win, I still think that poll was junk.
To give the Australian credit, they were the ones that gave Frydenberg an incredibly uncomfortable week this week, for possibly spuriously too. So occasionally they kind of jumped. We'll get into that a little bit. But, okay, so if there's a yes, if the polls go the way that we think we're going to, let's talk a little bit more about what we expect to happen, because there are still all kinds of scenarios. Tony Abbott at one point said he would respect the result, but as we know, he's a bit of a weather vane on most topics. So will there be an attempt to try and stop this somehow, or will this actually resolve things and they'll kind of go, look, we've lost this particular battle, let's get back to the rest of the war of actually staying in government? What do you think is going to happen, Sally?
Like the right faction of the coalition and conservatives within parliament will do everything they can to stop this from happening. Michael Sukkar, who is a member of the far right faction of the Liberal Party, he's already talking about up to 100 amendments on the marriage equality, the Dean Smith bill, which came about from a Senate inquiry on marriage equality. It's sort of viewed as this consensus bill.
Is his plan to like name individually every baker that won't have to cook for gays?
And every kind of cake that they're allowed to eat.
We're already seeing that there's rumours that faction are drafting their own marriage equality legislation, which is kind of delicious because we don't know the result yet. But they will do everything they can to muddy the waters, to try and attack, to decimate this bill with amendments, to make it impossible to pass, to drag this on. We are going to do everything we can to stop that from happening, but we have a big task ahead of us.
So it's interesting, because I mean, I was hoping that with the legitimacy that comes from those numbers, from such a high turnout, that it would be a fairly simple business. That's certainly what the Prime Minister will want, but as we know, he doesn't tend to get what he wants.
The technical thing is, look, the bill is going to go up. Say they put the Dean Smith bill up. It'll have the second reading, which is basically the debate in principle. Everyone gets up and says what they do or don't like about this bill and why it's a good thing or why it's a bad thing. And at the end of that process, it'll pass the second reading and go into committee. And that's when the fun starts, because in committee, that's where you can move amendments. You debate the bill clause by clause and move amendments. And that's where all the action will be. And the aim of those who want to weaken the bill to make same-sex marriage less equal will be to try and get amendments put in that stage, which means when it comes out of committee, either the bill as amended with those amendments put in will either be rejected and therefore same-sex marriage won't go ahead, or it will go up with the amendments. It has to do that in both houses, so that's going to be the difficulty. And for anyone trying to do this, I think the numbers are different. But the one problem that there may be is that conservatives in the Liberal Party may expect to have some win on something on this process, and there may be a caucus agreement of the Liberal Party to back one type of amendment. I've got no involvement, yeah. I've got no idea, but I've seen enough of this sort of legislation and how it goes through Parliament to know that's the way it works. It's when it's in committee, you try and amend the bill either to make it unacceptable for when it comes out of committee, or you amend it in such a way that the amendment you've got in actually is the one you want.
I mean, the entire idea of the plebiscite and then the postal survey came because Warren Entsch was threatening to try and make something happen, and it was a delaying tactic that they signed up to in that marathon joint party meeting that shouldn't have been a joint party meeting and all that kind of stuff. Andrew, what do you think is going to happen? If there's a big yes vote, where do we go from there?
Look, I think as long as Kevin Andrews gets an amendment in there that recognises relationships between cycling buddies, I think it's going to fly through committee.
No, that's where the Corey Bernardi amendments come in, because what cyclists really want to do is marry their bikes.
Well, I would have thought Kevin Andrews would have thought, what a great chance to sell more marriage counselling vouchers to the community.
That's a very good point.
It's a jamboree for his wife to...
Maybe there'll be compulsory counselling from Kevin Andrews himself and or his cycling buddies.
It's going to be a...
Everybody else has seen the John Oliver thing, right? So we know what we're getting at when we say cycling buddies.
Yeah, good.
I'm in a cycling club, I'll have you know. I ride.
We all know what
Europe.
He means when he says cycling club, right?
Yeah, the legal definition of cycling club is going to change very, very soon. But I mean, there are all kinds of interesting possibilities, aren't there? The private members' bill that's coming up before, the gay Liberal MPs who wrote the bill and were going to pass it. Is there any chance of them splitting with their colleagues and saying, let's just get this done? We've played your game for months.
Look, I think one of the issues is people think when you've got a finely divided parliament, it's actually easy to pass stuff. It's not, because, I mean, this is in the end why Julia Gillard wouldn't back gay marriage, because it would have been another broken promise. That's why she wouldn't budge on it. In this parliament, look, there's only going to be a minority of the government back a bill, is my view. And therefore, the question of government unity is an issue, and in a time when they may be about to lose members out of parliament, when they may have by-elections coming out, as we discussed afterwards, where they lose their majority, then sticking together may be a big issue. So that is, you know, I know people get very interested in the one issue, but same-sex marriage and these sorts of so-called conscience issues, they cross the party lines. Australian political parties are still built overwhelmingly on class lines, workers versus bosses versus country. I mean, it's an inherited class allegiance, but that's what the parties are aligned behind. They're not aligned behind an issue like this. And so it's very difficult when a debate like this comes up to talk about it, except, you know, to avoid the partisan stuff that comes up. And there will be a lot of pressure within the Liberal Party to avoid a split. And Australian political parties do not split. I mean, we saw it in Britain, we saw it in New Zealand, and we recently saw it in Germany on same-sex marriage legislation, that the ruling Conservative Party split, and the majority of Conservatives in all three countries did not vote for same-sex marriage, but it passed. But that is in parliaments where it's much more acceptable to vote against your party. Voting against your party in Australia is deeply unusual and is a bad career move. And so, you know, given everything else that's going on in politics, it may well be. I mean, they've got 2 weeks now where they said they're going to debate this. There is now a million other things running in politics. I wouldn't mind betting it somehow gets kicked off into the new year, and then you've got maybe an early election, and then it all happens afterwards again.
That would be a bizarre tragedy if the general chaos of this government... We'll get onto that chaos in just a moment. Before we do, Sally, any last thoughts? I mean, you're clearly very aware that the battle's not won yet, that this is... we don't know what the result will be, but even assuming it's a yes, that's not the end of the process, and it won't be until the law is actually proclaimed.
I mean, my final thought, and with the acknowledgement that I, because I'm a campaigner, I'm obviously an optimist, but, you know, when the government announced the plebiscite 2 years ago at the end of November, we had fought so hard for a free vote, and they gave us this plebiscite, and they said it was plebiscite or bust, and we campaigned and we campaigned, and Parliament rejected that legislation twice. And then they told us that marriage equality was off the cards forever. It's not going to happen until the next election. Forget about it. And then within a year, it was back on the agenda. And we had those six, in the end, Liberal MPs who were threatening to cross the floor to bring their own bill. And that ended up bringing us to having a postal vote, which, you know, was not where we wanted to be. But here we are. We are probably going to win this postal vote. So even if we don't win marriage equality this year, we have been told time and time again that, like, well, that's the end of it. You're not going to get that till the next parliament. And time and time again, this campaign has proved people wrong. And we're not there yet, but we're getting so close.
My one warning to people who get excited about the result is, in the end, I mean, I disagree with plebiscites on policy issues, because we live in a system of representative government. We elect representatives to make decisions, and it's there on their conscience. Now, this vote has happened, and now they are all going to talk about their conscience. What was the point of the vote? We have had three previous votes on issues in this country, two on conscription in the First World War and one on the national anthem.
We made a terrible decision. And that's Australian fair as well.
And the rest of them have been on in the States, have been about daylight saving, pub closing hours and the like.
We can't even resolve daylight saving as a nation.
So in my view, we live in a system where politicians make these decisions. It's their choice. It's there to debate the issues. And that's what they should do. And so that's why I don't think there should be a problem. It's got nothing to do with the issue. It's got nothing to do. It's entirely with the principle that we do not live in a system of direct democracy. If you want direct democracy, go live in California or Switzerland. Nobody else has it. We have parliamentary democracy. We elect representatives to consider the issues, look at the details, and vote. We don't sort of expect them to fobby back at us.
If you want to avoid it, and to avoid it, and to avoid it.
If you want to work with direct democracy, come and join GetUp. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Like, take action collectively and make change. We win stuff.
They really do. I remember going actually to some of the very early meetings of GetUp, and just some of my old friends were involved in setting it up, and it was amazing. It was just a couple of people meeting in a cafe and talking big, and it's now this incredible player to the point where the coalition are constantly trying to destroy it. So, look, you've got to be flattered by the vendetta, surely.
There's a theory in campaigning written by Saul Alinsky, and it's called "Power is what your opponents think you have," and we have never been more powerful than we are under this government.
Every morning, when Peter Dutton wakes up from another unsettled night's sleep,
get up. Look, let's take a break there. We'll talk more about the citizenship issues and the general malaise in Australian politics. I need a drink. The bar's over there. We'll talk in 10 minutes. Thanks.
And I'm afraid that's all we have for you from the event at Giant Dwarf, because our rule is we don't podcast the second halves. Everyone's had a few more drinks. Talk gets a little bit loose. You've just got to be there. The next event is on the 14th of December. You can book giantdwarf.com.au. If not when you hear this, then very shortly. The guests once more, Lenore Taylor and Sean Kelly. My co-host, of course, is Andrew P. Streets. Catch you in the next edition.